And welcome back to House of Comments. We had a rather manic year in politics in 2022. I'm sure 2023 will be calm. I'm Charlotte Henry, and joining me for this lovely new year, as always, is Emma Burnell. How are you, Emma?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Happy New Year. Nice to be back. We're going to have a nice, quiet, calm year in politics, aren't we?
Well, I don't think we're going to have
that. Oh, my God. If you guys could see Emma's face, she's not convinced.
I mean, to be fair, I am fairly convinced that it's going to be a lot calmer than last year, because nothing could be as mad. And it is very much in the interest even of the biggest headbangers in the Tories to have a slightly less mental year.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
But I don't think it will be like completely plain sailing. I mean, we've already seen that the Tory backbenchers are not going to go quietly. So there's going to be a lot of friction. There just won't be quite the explosions that there were last year. I mean, I don't expect that we'll see three prime ministers.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they're going to try and show a bit of order and karma. I think you're definitely right about that. And the political year has kicked off. We had two speeches to start the political year from the leaders of the two main parties, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and then Keir Starmer. Now, it was interesting. I was sort of quite impressed with the Rishi Sunak one in the sense that he just stopped being... Right. Because having watched him basically since he took office...
Being treated like a primary school child.
There was a bit of that, and he always has that tone. But what I did like was there was... He slightly shifted from that managed decline talk, which I... as you know, got really fed up with at the end of last year. And there at least seemed to be something there that was moving forward. The one thing that I'm always frustrated about in these speeches, and I think from whoever it is, frankly, and I think you'll probably share my frustration on this, is that constant reference to sort of parents and families. And that I find that so annoying. I mean, I could go on about this for ages because it drives me mad, but I won't rant at you our first week back. But, you know, that kind of pretending, and he did sort of do families mean different things and whatever. But I find that whole thing deeply frustrating.
It's the water in which we swim, to be honest.
Yeah.
I've given up. Yeah. Saying, hey, what about middle-aged single women?
Yeah, well, quite so. That's exactly how I feel. And anyway, all that stuff always annoys me. All politicians do it, and it really annoys me. Right.
Yeah.
Now, neither of them, there was one thing which we will come to in Keir Starmer's speech, which we do have to dig into, which was more substantive, sort of. But neither of them were particularly substantive, and lots of people tried to use that as a criticism. I wasn't particularly bothered by that at this stage.
NDA's speeches, they're never substantive. They always do, and they're about setting a tone for the way that they want to talk about the rest of the year. I thought that there was a decent amount of, not policy, but policy kind of shape in Labour's, and there was some goal setting in Sunak's.
Yep.
We can talk about the efficacy of those goals.
Yeah, we should. But so there were, let's do that actually. There were five pledges.
In terms of tone, they were perfectly fine New Year's speech. Well, I mean, there's a difference between tone and delivery.
Right.
In terms of tone, they were perfectly fine. Both perfectly fine New Year's speeches, the kind of thing you expect to say, this is how I intend to spend the rest of the year. That
I entirely agree. Yeah, I entirely agree. And kind of, I think people in the press and so on were sort of like, where's the substance? As you rightly, this is not what these speeches are about.
And I think the press, I'm starting to get really, really annoyed, actually, at the commentariat at the moment, because it's just this constant...
What, like us?
Well, yes, but I mean, I think this constant... Oh, God, politics is so awful. I just spend my entire life immersed in it for no reason. You're like, then get another job. I'd love to have your bloody job. Fuck off.
Right. So someone give Emma a lobby pass. But let's talk about, first, we will come to Keir Starmer, of course. Actually, just before we go into each of the individuals, the one thing I did notice, And I wonder if you felt the same watching those speeches. Is for the, you know, I've spent a few weeks, you remember how fed up I was at the end of the year going, blah, they're both so beige. What's the point? They're both the same. And actually, I thought for the first time in these speeches, we really started to see some genuine dividing lines, some genuine differences between the two. And you can pick which one you like, and that's fine. And that's what politics is. But they weren't just the nice, neither they weren't just two nice middle-aged guys in the managing stuff.
There's an awful lot. I mean, I think Rishi Sunak was very much trying to do, I am a nice middle-aged bloke managing stuff. That's his pitch.
For sure.
But I think the difference was, for me, that Starmer was, you know, he keeps getting accused of managerialism, but actually what he was setting out was quite big changes to the way the country was.
I thought for the first was,
and you I think Sunak had to say, hey, calm hand on the tiller. These are the five quite goals that I reckon I can hit. I mean, I reckon he's wrong, but that, as you say, you can choose which approach you like, but the idea that there's something samey about them. And I think it comes back to this whole vibes thing. Oh, they offer the same vibe. Well, I don't care about that. I offer what difference they'll make to my life. And there is quite a big difference in there.
I think for the first time, since they were both in these power, I did really feel some dividing lines opening up. And, you know, as I say, I think that as a general principle is not a bad thing. So let's talk about Sunak's goals. Now, there was a couple of things. So first of all, he talked about halving inflation, which, you know, we would all like to see happen. But this is a slightly, I don't want to say naughty, but let's be honest.
He's got a lot of to do with him.
No, that's not the point. That's not the point I was going to make. The point I was going to make was that most forecasts suggest that is going to happen anyway. So it
So it's like I'm setting myself a goal of being me at the end of the year. Right, well done.
It is a goal he can be relative. Look, we know that stuff happens. We've seen that over the last year. But he can be relatively confident that that will happen. And so, yeah, he put that in. Similarly, lots of forecasts.
Also worth noting on that halving inflation takes us to about 4.5%. Steve Barclay's currently talking about giving the nurses a 2% pay rise. So that would still be yet another real terms pay cut for nurses.
And
something that doesn't seem to have been much commented on.
And the other thing that he talked about was growth basically by the end of the year, which again, forecasts suggest is going to happen anyway. So a couple of them he's already talked about. We obviously know he talked about continuing some kind of mass education until 18. Now, look, I wouldn't have been happy having to do this because I wasn't particularly good at maths, but perhaps that is an argument in favour of what he was suggesting. The one thing I did want to raise to you with this is a lot of the points he raised about continuing maths were good, talking about the kind of data-driven jobs of the future, and that is clearly true. And you do need some of that skill set. What worried me and upset me, and this I suspect you share this view, is how easily the arts and humanities, which Britain is genuinely a world leader in, and genuinely, you know, culturally, look at the way in America they lap up British drama and shows. It's it's all very well to say everyone should be tech savvy and math savvy, and that's all good things. I wish my math was better. I wish I could code better.
Well, I did maths to 18 and I can't code or add up, to be honest.
Right. But I think we mustn't, and a government must not let the humanities and the arts just be seen as second class.
No, and it's so, I'm not against. I would like to see us move to a baccalaureate system. Under such a system, there would be maths education to 18. But what I don't want is some sort of piecemeal intervention where we go, let's talk about this thing because it pleases this constituency, rather than thinking, what do we want education to do? How will it do it best? And how do we therefore make changes to the whole system and do it wholesale rather than just tinkering and tinkering and tinkering and tinkering? And yeah, that for me, it's just pointless postery tinkering that makes him feel like he's Tim Jobs, Steve Jobs.
Well, that was quite clever. You did Tim Cook and Steve Jobs merged them into one.
Steve Jobs, yeah.
You merged them into one super Apple CEO.
But it felt like the classic Rishi Sunak problem of I've spent slightly too much time in Silicon Valley and slightly too little time in Reading.
Yeah, again, not necessarily convinced that's a problem in and of itself. I mean, if you're the Prime Minister, you do need to spend time in Reading and everywhere else in the country. I don't think it's a bad thing to have a broader perspective around the world. I think sometimes British politics, dare I suggest, can be a bit parochial.
It can be, but there is other places outside the UK than Silicon Valley.
Of course, sure.
I mean, your fucking Nick Clegg works there. I don't want to go anywhere near it.
He's back in London now. He's based in London.
So
you might have to move house then. But yeah,
and absolutely not. This is my place, not his.
But anyway, there was one of the things. Just back to the tone of the Sunak speech before we come back to Starmer. It was kind of a bit meant to be an anti-Boris speech. He was quite keen on talking about, you know, you hold me to account, basically. What he basically means is you can vote me out in the next general election if you don't think this has worked. I thought the tone was also...
Yeah, and I think that's a big gamble because, frankly, sure. Promise number one, as we both said, pretty deliverable. Promise number two, what were the other promises? I'm trying to even remember now. The economy will be growing by the end of the year.
Yep.
I mean, there may probably be like 0.01% growth by the end of the year, but it's not what the economists are forecasting. They're not forecasting growth until next year. But even if he gets 0.01% growth, the problem is he might get a newspaper headline. He will not get people feeling that.
Right, that's a really important point. Because what he's relying on is people feeling better in their pockets.
Yeah, exactly. And I just don't see that happening. I say 4.5% inflation is still fairly bad inflation.
For the era that we're living in.
Inflation to deal with small boats. Well, that's right. Not going to do anything for anybody.
I have to stop you there. Because, I mean, I have to say I'm not motivated at all by the small boat thing. I tend to lean on the side of just being deeply, deeply concerned about the people in the boats and wanting to get them to land and safe. But I can see if you're living in a coastal town, in Kent or whatever, that does bother you.
I'm going to stop there. I'm on GB News every bloody minute of the day at the moment. I know that
right, exactly,
are a big issue for a certain set of voters. What I'm saying is what he said on in his speech will not touch the sides with those voters. They don't think that the current process is working.
Yeah.
If all that Rishi Sunak does is passes new laws that aren't implemented by the end of the year, they will not think he's succeeded. That's my point.
Okay, that makes sense. I do agree with you on that. I thought you talked about as a matter of principle, it didn't matter. No.
I get that I'm weird in that I care more about the people in the boats than the image of the boats arriving. 40,000 people in real terms is not actually that many. And a great many of them do actually get refused. But I get that the visual really does upset a lot of people and people in coastal towns and people like I've got family in Thanet. I know that it's a big deal and I don't want to come across as an out of touch London metropolitan elite. That's not what I'm saying.
Established my role as that. Yeah. This is absolutely the sort of issue throughout the speech, probably both speeches, to be fair, that the devil will be in the detail. And the emphasis, of course, as the one in government, is on Rishi Sunak to provide the detail. So, there was all of that. And just one final thing I wanted to kind of build up was this idea. It was a bit of anti-Boris, wasn't it? Because, as I said at the beginning, I quite liked his shift away from managed decline to trying to be positive. Because let's be honest, what he said and the way he framed this speech was basically the only option he has now. He has to frame it as, I'm going to start doing these things in the general election in 18 months. Please give me a chance to finish them. That was the framing. Yeah. That's what, and basically that's the only chance he's got, right?
That's all he's got, really. to be fair. I mean,
yeah, it is all he's got. No, that's all he's got.
But it's not terribly inspiring.
No, not really, but it's the best card he's got after 12, 13 years in power.
Exactly.
But what he didn't do, which I also liked, was he didn't do the Boris Johnson-style boosterism. He tried to have some positivity in there, but he didn't do the everything's going to be fabulous. And I was quite pleased not to have that anymore.
He didn't do the boosterism, which I think he couldn't get away with. It's not his style.
It's not his style at all.
He did that sort of patronising optimism thing that was, hey, children.
No, I don't agree with that. I think we need a bit of optimism.
We may need a bit of optimism. I don't need patronising about it. It was so patronising. So the delivery was so patronising.
I didn't,
honestly,
look,
it felt like down to, and I don't usually feel like that.
I didn't particularly feel like that. I know what you mean. His tone is not great. I didn't particularly feel like that, but I know some people did. Right, let's get to Sakir. Again, not much substance. Doesn't bother me that much. Don't think there's emphasis on him to do it. It's January 2023. Yeah, we you know, he's not announcing his manifesto. Not bothered by that. Okay. This is a very facetious question to ask you. So first of all, probably next time you do a big speech, make sure the sound's working at the beginning. Not good presentation.
I mean, I don't massively judge him on that, but yeah, getting the tech right would be a good start.
It goes against, whether it's obviously not at all his fault, but it goes against him. And it was all a bit glitchy, whatever. The real sort of facetious thing I want to ask
about.
I mean,
it's ironic because it was tech
hub. Right, exactly. What do we think of the no jacket, sleeves rolled up, ready for action look?
I mean, it's a classic Blair, isn't it?
That's exactly my thought.
And to be fair, Cameron did it. It's a shorthand for male politicians to say, I'm getting down to work. Do I care about it very much? No. Do I think it probably works as a shorthand? Yes. Beyond that, I really wouldn't have more thoughts on it.
No, it did make me chuckle because, as you say, classic Bear. Now, there's a couple of key lines we need to discuss, but the one we have to start in with is the one written by Dominic Cummings, which is the Take Back Control Bill. How do you feel about Dominic Cummings doing Labour comms?
It's a good... I mean, the thing about Dominic Cummings is he's fucking good at communications. I've clearly decided to swear a lot more this year. I do apologise. So you're going to have to bleep the hell out of me throughout this podcast or give us an L rating. He's very, very good at comms. And I think this does two jobs. I think it says to people who voted for Brexit and are nervous about Keir Starmer, we get that you're listening to us, or at least that's the aim of it. Mm-hmm. Remain to be seen whether that's works, but that's clearly what they're aiming to do. And also it does actually put some flesh onto the bones as to what taking back control might feel like under a Labour government. And I think that's a good thing. It's clearly building on the Brown Commission. And again,
I wrote in my notebook
The stuff about devolution, which I'm much more interested in than the endless ding dongs on the House of Lords. Mm-hmm. And I think that could make a real difference. And it's also politics without the big checkbook, which is the other big thing.
Yeah, I want to come on to that, but I just want to finish this bit on the Take Back Control Bill.
But I think they're two sides of the same coin. That's what I'm saying. I think that kind of constitutional change doesn't cost a lot, but could change a lot.
Yeah. Well, you said I'm glad you said you thought it hung off the Gordon Brown recommendation, which we discussed the other week in quite a lot of depth, actually. And what I wrote in my notebook
local government geek talking about stuff.
Yeah. And well, it was interesting and important. And when I heard that phrase, I also wrote in my book, assume link to Gordon Brown. So I'm glad you agree with me on that, because it's the first thing my ears pricked up. I was going to sort of, yeah, I'm glad that we both agree on that, because it seemed that's what it's building on. The sort of wonkery is the Gordon Brown stuff. The stuff that gets presented to the public is this thing called a Take Back Control Bill. The other thing I thought that was, I guess the word is impressive, I'm not sure, but anyway, what I thought was clever, let me put it that way, and good framing, was in this section about that. He said, even when I was going around campaigning for a second referendum, I spoke to people who were Leave and actually couldn't disagree with any of the reasons they wanted to vote Leave.
Yeah, the kind and he's of right.
Public services. And
I think that there's been too much just absolute dismissal of Leave voters as idiots, despite the fact that they had a perfectly reasonable analysis of where the country was at. I may disagree with their solution for that, but I too can't fault their reasoning.
Right. And I thought that was quite clever because it's very easy to dismiss Keir Starmer as another Islington posho leader who doesn't understand what's going on. And that may be the reality. Who knows? I don't know him. But to frame it like that and to begin to put that out there is quite clever. I'm just wondering, how do you think this will be taken inside the Labour Party using that language?
I think there'll be a few Remain headbangers who will... The people who think we can go back tomorrow, despite the fact that we absolutely could not go back tomorrow and the EU probably wouldn't have us at the moment, will take it badly and they'll be loud and noisy on Twitter and the rest of the party will put their heads down and think, we've had 13 years of Tory government, we want to win. There is nothing quite so disciplining as the fact that you're close to victory. And I think the Labour Party are feeling that more than they've felt it for a really, really long time. And so I don't think that this is going to be, and I think there's going to be a misunderstanding of that by the left who will say, but you made such a fuss about Corbyn. And it's like, well, that was because A, that was before we left. Circumstances are very different now.
You mean him not being a particularly effusive supporter of Remain?
Yeah, exactly. And it did divide the Labour Party between 2017 and 2019. That was part of Corbyn's problem internally, which it isn't part of Keir Starmer's problem internally, despite Starmer being more of a Remainer than Corbyn was. So I think it will play into some of the narratives that only really exist on the extremes of Twitter, but we see too much of because we exist on the extremes of Twitter.
Right. Oh, and so let's go back to the other point you quite rightly raised, which was Starmer's line that none of this, i.e., you know, the thought of taking back control and a lot of the other things he was advocating for, the bits in society he wants fixing over, he talked about a decade, again, looking long term, was none of this should be taken as a code for Labour getting its big government checkbook out, he said. That struck me as interesting for two reasons. One, because normally we see, you know, again, very Blairy, wasn't it, to try and they decided to stick to Conservative Tory plans in their first spending plans in their first term in 1997.
Which is a massive mistake, as Ken Clark has said, because he made their Tory plans completely eye-watering as a result.
And it's still this idea of reiterating the need for any Labour leader, really, but particularly Keir Starmer at the moment, because he's following Jeremy Corbyn, to reiterate fiscal responsibility, costing. He really has to keep doing that, doesn't he?
He does. He shouldn't have to because there are arguments to be made for increased public spending. There are not currently arguments that could be politically made for increased taxation, though. So you'd need to make those carefully and sensibly. I think Rachel Reeves is doing a good job at separating out borrowing for day-to-day spending, which I don't think any government can do, particularly not after Liz Truss, and borrowing for capital spend, where you have an actual asset that you're investing in. Very, very different type of borrowing. I think Labour's plans to change the energy economy are going to make quite a big difference. And there's also if this devolution stuff works, there will be less that you'll break the relationship between the Treasury and local government in quite important ways that then won't be about central government getting its big checkbook out, but might well be about local places shifting their own burdens of taxation. So I think this is more interesting, but that might be me imposing my highly localist lens on it.
As I say, I thought Keir Starmer did pretty well. The one bit I nearly turned the TV off for and couldn't have coped if he'd have said it one more time is this phrase, sticking plaster politics. Now, I actually agree with his analysis that politics, particularly in Westminster, is far too short-termist. I actually think he's completely right about that. We see it all the time.
It's almost a no-brainer. Everyone thinks he's right. Fewer people will say it, but I mean, everyone agrees that that's...
We see that far too often. Whoever's in power, whoever's on, you know, doing whatever, stumbling from one crisis to another, just trying to keep the show on the road. He's absolutely right about that. But the phrase really annoyed me. And never mind that. I cannot imagine anyone in the public will hear that phrase and be like, well, that I'm voting for him now. Like, I just don't, I can't see how that's going to work in the politics.
I think actually people, I mean, it's the classic Mandelson line. As soon as you're sick of hearing it, they might just have heard it. Sick of saying it, they just have heard it. I think that it's perfectly viable to find a decent phrase and repeat it a lot. It's basic politics. It's politics 101.
Yeah, I just don't think it's a decent phrase.
I think it's a fine phrase. I mean, it's not exactly a new phrase. They haven't invented it. No. Sticking past the solutions has long been a phrase that's been used in all sorts of contexts. So people understand it. That's the main thing. People are, you know, they're aware of exactly what it means. It's not something that has to be over-explained.
I'll take your word for it. There was one other interesting element that sort of came from the Q&A. Was so Keir didn't commit to scrapping tuition fees, which is you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that is the kind of thing that does motivate the Labour base, the idea of scrapping tuition fees. I know all too well.
It's a young, noisy Labour base.
I know all too well what happens within the party.
Right.
I think he is right. Yes, trust me.
Fundamentally, needs reform because the idea that it should have the same sort of levels of interest as any other loan is bonkers. But we do need funding into the higher education sector, and it also shouldn't be the key government priority. Government priority should be 0 to 5 first, 5 to 11 second, 11 to 18 next. The idea of tertiary education being a priority is bonkers, as far as I'm concerned. We need that sector. It's a good sector. It's an important sector. It's part of our exports to the world. Mm-hmm. But that it should be a primary funding responsibility of government is just not the case. It's not how you change the world.
So I thought his sort of political positioning was quite nice. And as someone who lived through the Lib Dems getting then completely in a tangle and disaster over this, he may have saved himself from disaster.
Don't promise students something and let them down is the lesson of the Lib Dems.
He may also have, as you know, got himself in a position where he's pissing some part of his voter base and membership off, but we'll see. So yeah, that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true, but those people tend to live in urban metropolitan seats where the Labour majorities are 20,000. So you can lose a bit of those votes to the Greens. And frankly, that's a political consideration. I think that's a reasonable political consideration.
Well, we'll see how this all plays out. Anyway, it was an interesting start to the year. I look forward to, as the months go on, we'll get a more bit more flesh on these bones from both leaders, I hope. But as we say, for now, setting out a vision from both of them is not such a big deal. Let's go stateside just to finish the show, Emma. Just briefly.
Can I swear more now?
I think you might not be the only one swearing in frustration. So as we record the show... Yeah, quite so. As we record this show, they are probably just waking up in Washington. They've had 11 consecutive House roll call votes to try and select the Speaker of the House, which was assumed to be former Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who is a congressman from California.
Yeah.
Kevin McCarthy has lost 11 of these votes because 20, and I'm going to say, and I don't care how pretentious I sound, 20 nutters on the fringe of his party are refusing to vote for him. Congressman Matt Gaetz has even decided to nominate Donald Trump to be the Speaker of the House. This, quite frankly, is a shambles.
It's completely shambles.
They seem to be...
Was it Johnson who said the first rule in politics is learn to count?
So you think this is Kevin McCarthy's fault?
I think as much as anything, yeah, he should never have let it get to a vote. You've got to have the numbers before you go. And if you look at Nancy...
Nancy Pelosi,
she never lost a vote. She had a slimmer majority and she never lost a vote because she knew how to work the room before you got to the vote. That Kevin McCarthy cannot corral his troops is his failing.
I guess it must. Yeah, ultimately, you must be right. It also seems completely mad to me that the Republicans, who battled so hard to get a majority and, you know, messed up getting over the line in the Senate, just about kept alive in the House and kept, you know, managed to get a smaller majority than they wanted, but still managed to get it over the line in the House, cannot get it together and go, actually, this looks absolutely terrible to the country that we can't arrange.
Well, this is the right-wing problem. We've got it to an extent in this country, but they've got it in spades in America. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe in government, fundamentally don't believe in government, then you are going to elect a certain proportion of nutters to government who will just blow it all up because they fundamentally believe that's what they're there to do.
I mean, I find it hard to construct an argument against it. I don't know if that's actually what's happening or they're just, you know, not really thinking the consequences through politically.
I don't think it's that. I genuinely think they are there to blow shit up. And they don't care if that harms the Republican Party on the way because their bigger goal is to end any reasonable form of government.
I have to be honest, I don't know enough about the 20 that are causing the problems to know if that's true. I'm sure... that they are, I mean, I know they are small government kind of, I was going to say take back control people, but I just don't understand how you can go back to your constituency having caused this shambles and go, look what I did, it was great. And there, look, it would be very easy for you and I to sit here and laugh. And, you know, the Democrats were doing that and I don't blame them. There was these wonderful pictures of various Democrat congressmen. Yeah, oh, sort of,
at the end of the 11th.
They were sitting there.
Jeffries keeps winning the vote, just not by the majority needed. So because the Democrats have been...
There was pictures of the Democrats, you know, sitting there with big buckets of popcorn. I think apparently what happens is because there's no speaker, there are no rules effectively on the floor of the House. Yeah. And so they can... I think they've been sitting there with booze. They've been eating popcorn. And I get why you would sort of want to take the mick at this, you know, as it all falls apart. There are some serious implications to this I was reading. So, for example, there's increasing concern that people cannot get security briefings because there's no House and there's no Speaker of the House and therefore...
They can't do any business in the House until a Speaker is elected. That's the rules of the Senate.
Correct. And part of that means that people who would normally get... pretty very important security briefings. You know, America is sending a lot of weaponry to Ukraine. There's people in Congress that need these briefings. You basically can't, and the Intelligence Committee or whatever it's called, cannot get these briefings. I think there are ways that the White House could get information to people if they really needed it. But it's this is a serious problem. And if you then want to go, you know, the next midterms, the election in 2024 for president, and you want to go as a Republican and say, we're the responsible ones. Look at the terrible things Joe Biden, we assume, has done to the country. And you've behaved like this and put, you know, some quite serious security issues potentially on the country. I think that's a pretty hard case to make. Anyway, as I say, as we record, we'll get to 11 votes. We're at 11 votes. By the time you listen to this, I can only guess what number of votes we were in. Oh, Emma, it's good to be back.
And the other thing is, he'll probably get it eventually, but with absolutely no power.
Yes, he's because he's sort of given away the house, literally.
He's given away everything. Also, he's completely undermined by this whole process.
Yeah.
The Democrats have demonstrated real discipline. You know, it's not going to be the 2 years they were hoping for.
No. No, it's a mess. It is a mess. Right. Luckily, we're not a mess. We're back. You can follow us on Twitter, by the way. It's at HOCpod. Come find us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come join us there and you'll get alerted whenever we put out a new episode and, you know, whatever other trouble we get up to. Emma, where are you on the Twitters?
I am Emma Burnell _.
And you've got a Substack as well.
I do. Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter, and you can find my Substack at theaddition.substack.com. That's AWD. Well, it's been a nice quiet start to the year, and we'll be back next week.